Hi there, and welcome back to the Who Goes There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Chip Mullins, and we are going to be discussing Stand on Zanzibar by John Bruner, which won the 1969 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Chip, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, been looking forward to this.
Absolutely.
I have to admit, I almost introduced you as Chad Mulligan.
That would have been great. He's my favorite character in the book.
Yeah, me too. And it's a lot of the same letters in your name.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, Chip, why don't you introduce yourself and talk some about your history as a science fiction fan?
Well, my name is Chip, like you mentioned. I'm a musician in the Marine Corps. I play tuba and baritone.
Nice.
My history with science fiction started kind of when I was in college. When I was growing up, I read a lot of Stephen King and saw a lot of horror movies, probably way too young for all of those things. But in college, a friend of mine gave me Game of Thrones, the first novel for the Song of Ice and Fire series. Mm-hmm. I read that on a trip to Europe to a music conference, actually, and got hooked. And that is still my favorite series to date. So that sort of got me into reading more science fiction and fantasy books from there. I think I read the Foundation series trilogy. Then I started trying to look up, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I actually went back and read the three books. And from there, I sort of found the Hugo winners. And I started just kind of going through them. Tried to get a book club going here in Northern Virginia for a while. Took a little while, but I finally got one going for the past couple of years. Because of that, I think I've read about 30 to 32 of the Hugo winners.
Cool.
I have a list on Goodreads, but I've mixed some of the like novelettes and short stories and things like that in there. So I had to actually think about it.
Cool. So is that kind of a typical story of people finding the podcast is reading one of the Hugo winners and then Googling to try and find a podcast discussion of it?
Yeah, that's exactly how I found it.
Okay, cool. This is just a guess, but it kind of sounded like you were trending to be one of those. My Hugo count is up to 56 now. I actually have, I think, 21 more that I haven't read, but there's a couple that I have read that'll be rereads, and which makes it 24 episodes to go for. So from like this date, if there were no new winners, I'd be 2 years out from finishing. But there will be winners in 2021 and 2022. So
yeah.
Fall 2023, look for the final episode of this podcast.
There you go.
Yeah. So why this book?
Well, you gave me a choice of books. I tend to be a note taker, especially for my book club, just so I can remember. I'm kind of a slow reader. So if I start reading something and finish it a month or 2 months later, I won't remember what happened in the beginning.
Totally understand that.
So for this one, I was just kind of blown away by how much was in it. I wrote like 5 or 6 pages worth of notes, and this wasn't necessarily my favorite of the options that we had talked about, but there was so much going on that it was just, I think it'd be worth it to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. So how about we kind of move into our non-spoiler discussion and you try and give a quick elevator pitch for this book, if that can be done.
Yeah, I'll try. So the main characters of this book are Donald Hogan and Norman House, and they are roommates in New York City. Donald is a student, but secretly ready to be a spy or an operative for the government. Norman is an exec at General Technics, a company in New York City that also has a almost sentient computer called the Shamanizer.
Right.
The book has over 24 other POV characters or point of view characters, and is formatted with very unique chapter setup. You have continuity, context, the happening world, and tracking with close-ups.
Yeah.
The continuity chapters are the ones that keep the story moving, following mainly Donald and Norman. Tracking with close-ups gives us the glimpses of the other characters. Context and the happening world give the reader glimpses of what life is like around the Earth at this time. As for the story itself, the president of a country named Beninia in Africa is dying, and he's extremely afraid of what will happen to his country when he does, because the neighboring kingdoms are violent. And he's afraid they'll be taken over.
Right.
So he decides to do a deal with the U.S. ambassador to sort of have a U.S. company take over his country or the management of his country. The other storyline is Donald, of course. He's a student specializing in genetics, and he's been reserved by the government. And there's a country in the Pacific called Yatikang that suddenly announces a breakthrough in genetic engineering. So Donald gets, quote unquote, activated to go investigate that.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's as close as you can get to to kind of giving a synopsis to this, because like you said, with the four different sections, and we can talk about those a little bit individually as well, because like, if you want to know what the plot of the novel is, it's not a huge amount of plot really. Like, and the book really isn't about the plot, at least to me. It's more about the style. You could just read the continuity chapters, and that's where you get the, you know, the linear narrative of the story. And I'm not sure how much space that would take up. How long is this book? It's like 500 pages, something like that.
Yeah. The paperback I have is 640, something around okay. there.
Yeah.
And the chapters aren't very short. Like, the continuity being the longest chapters are only like 5 to 10 pages at right. a time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I guess this is kind of where we go into overall thoughts about the book. I had a hard time getting into this one because of that format. You know, I'm like, what is going on in these, especially the happening world chapters, where I was just like, this is nonsense. What yeah. is happening? And that makes them kind of difficult to, it took a long time for me to catch what is the thread we're supposed to be following here?
Especially because I think the happening world and context, like, one of them is like news bulletins.
Right.
So it'll just flash with something that has nothing to do with what we've been reading in the story.
Right. Yeah.
But later on,
dot, and move on to something else. Yeah.
Later on in the world and in the story, it kind of builds the picture of what's happening.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that's why I wanted to have this part of the discussion in the non-spoiler discussion, because I feel like it's important to know that going into the book, or at least it would be helpful to people to know that. Okay. Don't understand at the beginning, it might seem a little incoherent, but it does become more coherent as the story goes. And the happening world chapter is not necessarily becoming more coherent, but the overall flow of the narrative.
Yeah. Okay. In my notes, so I start like my first page with like main characters and the kind of the plot setting. Mm-hmm. And then I start my actual notes section, and I started writing down the characters as they were coming in these chapters. And I was like, what's going on? So then I devoted a whole page just to that and where they were. And so I could follow, like I said, because I'm a slow reader,
right?
Where I could follow them.
That's a good idea, actually. And, you know, some of them you could, if you wanted to criticize the book, right, you could be like, well, we could have pulled out a third of those characters and the book still would have been fine, right? We didn't necessarily need that, but it does add some color to the kind of world building. It's a unique way to do world building.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah. There's also, I can't remember if the Chad Mulligan chapters, are those typically in context?
Yes, they're context.
Yeah, those were fascinating. Just because you have this author of, I mean, he reminded me of Robert Heinlein a little bit, you know, kind of libertarian, mm-hmm. but having a book titled "You're an Ignorant Idiot."
Yeah,
that was great.
And his whole thing is hip crime,
right.
Highly important personages, and like right. their crimes, basically, because they think they run the world. And
yeah,
He reminded me of kind of like Jubal Harshaw.
Yes,
and who's I think probably my favorite Heinlein character to date. Mm-hmm. And I loved reading his chapters and. I think that's where, if Broner had something to say, that was where he was trying to say it, was through Chad Mulligan.
Yeah. Yeah. Author proxy kind of character.
Yeah.
Though it was interesting kind of where that character went, because he had a bit of a shift.
He definitely did.
Let's see. I'm trying to think what more we want to talk about in non-spoilers. Maybe, I mean, you mentioned that there's kind of the dual plot lines of the two roommates. And it's funny because like the storylines don't really intersect that much
in terms of
the overall book. They're both important plots, but they're not really bouncing off each other all that much, other than the fact that these guys just happen to be roommates, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and they don't like each other, mm-hmm. But for some reason towards the end of the novel they feel a connection or feel like they need to reconnect.
Right. Yeah, at the beginning they're just trading women, essentially, which
yeah one of the worst parts of the book.
Yes, very much. So how about some comps for this book? Can you think of anything to compare Stand on Zanzibar to?
Not too much. In preparing for this podcast, I knew that was one of the questions. And it's just a lot of like dystopian novels or stuff like that are set after whatever events happen to make mm-hmm. the world the way it is. This feels like it's like a setup. Like if we keep going the way we are, this is how 2010, when the novel takes place,
right.
what it might be like. And then just the way it's formatted with the different chapters, it's not like anything else I read.
Yeah. I understand that it's kind of modeled after the USA trilogy by John Dos Passos, and it has a very similar kind of format where it builds the world out in the same kind of way. But yeah, since I haven't read that, you know, I wouldn't add that in my comps. The comps that I wrote down Watchmen, the graphic novel, because you kind of have a layered narrative going on. And then there's interstitial chapters that are like dossiers and newspaper clippings and that kind of stuff that reminded me of some of the happening world kind of stuff. And then there's also the chapters with the Black Freighter. Have you ever read Watchmen?
No, I have not.
Okay. Yeah. I'd be curious what you'd think, about that comp. So
I'm not too, don't read too many graphic novels.
Okay. Another comp that I had was The Inevitable Conflict from Asimov, from iRobot, where you have the idea of computers or robots controlling an economy. And that kind of reminded me of the Shalmaneser and Beninia. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get confused between Beninia and Yetakang.
Yeah. Seems like that was a big idea at this time because in my book club, we started, you know, at the beginning with like 1953, 56. Yeah. And we're just getting to the mid 70s now. And so you have Mike from Moon is a Harsh Mistress. You have the computer from The Demolished Man, and stuff like that. You have these like omniscient computers that are deciding how humanity goes.
Yep. Yep. Or the, whatever the computer was from, They'd Rather Be Right as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Which, by the way, I really like that one. I do not think it's near the bottom of the Hugo list.
Right there with you. Yeah. Like Josh said on our episode, it has one idea, but it's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah. It was hard to read. The writing wasn't necessarily great, but the story was really, really great.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed that. I mean, it's probably worth mentioning before we head into spoilers, there's a lot of projected slang for this future. You know, it's only, 40, 45 years in the future from the standpoint of John Brunner, but I always kind of have a little bit of a problem with fake swearing. So, you know, sheeting hole. On the other hand, you know, like the reason that it's done is part of the problem for me. So like if I'm reading a young adult novel and it just has all of a sudden fake swears in it, I'm like, come on, it's not how language works. So stuff like The Maze Runner or Steelheart, you know, it's just, I want to fill my book with swearing, but I want to sell it to a young adult audience. Where here, I feel like he is trying to project that into the future a little bit.
Yeah, I actually like that because I thought it built out the world more logically, especially since I've had this conversation with friends and my book club.
Yeah.
When we first got cell phones, there was a character limit on text messages, so we had to change, you know, laugh out loud to LOL and other things like that. And that has actually kind of gone into our modern lexicon
very much.
So it was neat that he just use the word zek for executive in the book.
Yeah.
Mucker for someone who's running amok and killing people. I thought it was that he gave that thought of how humanity would talk 40 years from now. I thought that was a really good thing.
Yeah, I thought it was. I think the only exception that I have is the stand-ins for AM and PM, antimatter and Papa Mama. I'm like, we tend to go for brevity. And that is much more difficult to say. And I wonder if it's because John Brunner was British and you do have a lot of that kind of rhyming slang in especially Cockney English.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that's where that came from. But then usually you'd find that, you know, Papa Mama got then pushed down to something even more brief and you don't even know where that came from unless you ask somebody in the know.
But yeah. I think I only got that because of being military. Like,
oh, really?
We use acronyms or we spell out, you know, Alpha, Bravo, Tango, stuff like that. So
exactly. Yeah. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and head right over into spoilers and we can talk about whatever we want to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah. So hit your notes, pull out anything you want
to. I guess the first thing I wanted to talk about was kind of, I don't know if what Brunner was trying to say with General Technics taking over Beninia, because there's a chapter talking about, they're having like a board meeting with the president, Norman, the president of Beninia, Norman from General Technics, and several other people. And they're naming all the things that's going to happen to their country because of having a U.S. company take them over. They're going to have housing for everybody. They're going to have healthcare, improved healthcare for everybody, wages and a standard of living, job training, all these X, Y, and Z things. And I don't know, he put so much into that that I was wondering if that was part of something he was trying to talk about.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, just kind of extolling the virtues of the planned economy, right?
Yeah.
Which a lot of Americans, you know, we look at planned economy and we see that as like stuff that happened in the USSR and that kind of thing. But yeah, I'm not totally sure what he was trying to say there.
And they were taking out loans for all this stuff. And like, were they going to make enough money back to pay these loans for all this massive influx of people from around the world to teach them and train them and all this other stuff? It was interesting. Mm-hmm. Like the countries in Africa, today are modern countries, typically considered third world-ish. Mm-hmm. Sure. So like with more investment by wealthier nations like us or England or other countries around the world, could they raise their standard of living?
Right. And that verges on kind of the white savior motif, which is interesting because of course, Norman, who's high up in GT, is actually black. They use the term Afram.
Afram.
Some of the terms I felt like, okay, I can see where that comes from. And then there's other ones that I'm like, what? I mean, that's just a racial epithet that you're using there, you know, for like they called the Chinese slanties because of course he had them being the main enemy. That's not cool.
No.
I mean, it's understandable. I understand, like, in World War II, people referred to the Germans as krauts sometimes, and that was it's an us versus them kind of thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it tends to be like a rallying cry at the time. You know, you're sending all these young people against an enemy. You don't want to – you tend to dehumanize them to accomplish the thing that war has to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then that feeds down into the – subsequent generations, right, that grew up with their father using those terms, and eventually you start washing it out.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know, one of the racist terms that was used all over this book was just brown nose.
Yeah.
And I had never heard that growing up.
No, me neither.
I grew up in Maryland, kind of a country-ish area. Mm-hmm. But I had never heard that. So I don't know if that was modern or current usage in 1969. It is gone from where I am by today.
Yeah, I don't think it was. I think he was projecting that as something, I didn't care for that either. Hmm. And that's what, you know, people were self-identifying that way, right?
I think so. I think Norman thinks of himself like that or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the US ambassador and the president of Beninia, they didn't, I don't know how much we were inside their heads, but they never thought like that or talked like that.
Right.
It was all the US characters. And some of the European ones.
I guess in the non-spoilers, I didn't say my kind of overall thoughts on the book. I just said that it was difficult to get into. David Agronoff from the Dickheads podcast, this is his favorite. I'm not sure that I liked it as much as he did, but I can definitely see why it would get that strong of a reaction from someone. And I can see that if I reread it, I'd probably have an easier time connecting to it. It's one of these where I'm like, I really admire that book. I just feel like I need more time to sit with it to know how much I really, really like it. And because I think it's really, really good. And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the kind of predictions that Brunner got right. I mean, he got stuff wrong. Everybody gets stuff wrong. But it's pretty amazing how many things you could go down the list and tick off that were successful predictions. Even though that's, of course, not what science fiction is necessarily for, it can do that. And this book is a great example of that.
That's one of the primary searches results that comes up when you look up this book is science fiction predictions that came true.
Right.
And this book is like at the top of the list, which is kind of sad because it doesn't paint a positive picture of the future too much.
Yeah.
Your comment about getting more on a reread, I think because there is so much going in on this book, a reread would make it a lot better. And preparing for the podcast, I read this last summer. Yeah. So preparing for the podcast, I did read the last few hundred pages again, but I think at some point, if I get a break in my reading this year, I'm going to try and reread the whole thing just to kind of assimilate it again.
Yeah.
My overall thoughts, I think I mentioned this a little bit, wasn't a big fan of this book. There was a lot of racism. Like every character was racist, pretty much. The dystopian future, some of the other things in it, like he predicted Mr. and Mrs. Everywhere you know, will kind of control
reality TV.
Yeah. Reality TV, and like you pretend like you're in the TV. And then I think at one point he said something like the presidency will be determined by TV popularity instead of merits.
Right.
And not to get political, but one of the last candidates didn't have any political background. He was a TV reality star and a businessman, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just kind of crazy reading this.
Yeah. I even go far enough back, and that applies to like Ronald Reagan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know Ronald Reagan I've never seen anything that he's been in. So to me, mm-hmm. he's just the president, but yeah.
Right. Well, and he was a governor as well. So he did have some experience there. Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? As governor of California too. Yeah. And things like 24-hour news coverage, right? Where mm-hmm. there was, you could turn on the, what did they call it? A 3V? I can't remember what they called the television. You could turn that on at any time. The book has, you know, very broad acceptance of all kinds of relationships.
That is one good thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The population, you know, he projected the population being 7 billion in 2010.
Perfect.
He was right there. Even something as simple as like projecting, you know, a black man as almost a head of a company, right? Like this was not necessarily something that was obvious at various times in U.S. history.
And there were lots of women. There was a woman who was in charge of GT, a woman who was in charge of one of the eugenics companies.
Mm-hmm. We already mentioned supercomputers and big data. That's another prediction that's in there. Of course, you know, Shalmaneser is the size of a room probably. Although, you know, when you really look at it, right, you can build a fairly small supercomputer, but there are a lot of big server farms where AI workloads are running right now.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's fair to look at older science fiction and go, oh, you projected computers being so huge. I'm like, well, I mean, you have a room full of computers right now crunching numbers.
Yeah.
So it's just not one computer.
I was really expecting Norman to like talk or have conversations with the Shalmaneser like they did with Mike in Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah, very much.
I was just expecting like a back and forth rather than kind of just straightforward computer usage, I guess.
Yeah. And there's hints that Shalmaneser might be coming more than we think. And that's very interesting, but not really developed very far.
Yeah. One of the ancillary characters, Benny, this is in the spoiler section, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. A character named Benny, I think he's high all the time, and he keeps saying, what an imagination I've got. And then I think the very last line of the book is the Shalmaneser saying, what an imagination I've got.
Mm, right.
And so I didn't exactly remember how Benny died or if he died near the Shalmaneser, but.
One of the bits of slang that I really did like was orbiting, right?
Yeah. I did, at the end of my notes, I put bullets as to what I want to talk about in the book club. And the very first topic was drugs. Like everybody was on something. They would go to a party and they would just hand out, you know, drugs.
Yeah.
To kind of, as like a party favor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. or a corporation, excuse me, taking over a country in Africa was one of the big points.
Yeah.
They start sending out messages, you know, pretty much all over Earth for teachers and trainers and anyone with certain kinds of experience to apply. And there are several European characters in this. Two are French that their family history was like the ruling class of colonialism in Africa.
Right.
And they had always, I guess they were tired of being in France. They wanted to go back to Africa and they thought that this was a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite work out for them in that respect. Several other people, you know, they want to become teachers. Other people, because eugenics is a huge thing around the U.S., if not the world at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
48 of the U.S. states have eugenics laws. And
right.
if you have anything, your gene type is tested, kind of like 23andMe and stuff like that. And if anything is in there, you will not be allowed to have kids.
Right.
So this one couple goes to Benicia as teachers where they're allowed to get pregnant and have a child. So there are some success stories in this. Puerto Rico is a state at this point. They're just about to enact eugenics legislation.
Isn't the French couple a brother and sister, though?
They are brother and sister.
That was a little weird.
Yeah. In the spoiler section, I guess all the ancillary characters, almost all of them die. And if they don't, weird things happen to them, like the French couple.
Yeah.
I guess eugenics would be one of the other huge topics with this. Yadikang, you know, they want to create supermen to help push out, you know, the West, basically. They have a really good genetic scientist named Saiguntang. So they make this announcement that they can make these supermen. which is kind of a lie. The genetic scientist isn't there yet, mm-hmm. but the population of the country starts lining up to volunteer for this treatment or to voluntarily be sterilized so that they don't contaminate the population pool.
Right.
So Donald, the main character, gets sent to investigate this. He actually undergoes, so he leaves New York when he's activated and he gets something called Eptify or Eptification, where he's like mm-hmm. kind of Matrix, right? Yeah. Right. Neo in the Matrix. Like
just, I know Kung Fu.
Yeah. I know Kung Fu. So like 3 days or 5 days after being on this island, he's a trained assassin as well as all his regular knowledge. And he goes to Yatikang secretly to figure out what's going on, but also to meet Sai Guntang and help him defect at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's the question, right? Is this technology real? Is this genetic engineering actually real?
Yeah.
Because if it is and it's kept in this one country, right, they could breed a race of Superman.
Yep. Yeah, so the U.S. was trying to figure that out. It turns out, fortunately, the scientist wasn't quite ready to do that yet. The government had made a false claim.
Yeah.
And then he tries to get him out of there, and things kind of go haywire. But mm-hmm. a lot of sci-fi around this time, Seth, I wanted to ask you, is focused on population and population control.
Yeah.
And we saw that, you know, he predicted 7 billion people by 2010, and it's mm-hmm. pretty much hit the mark.
Yeah.
What did you think of the eugenics in this?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting, well, like the context of this novel is, it's not post-apocalyptic, right? It's like basically pre-apocalyptic, where like humanity is headed towards a crash and you're seeing a couple of attempts to avert it. You know, one of them using artificial intelligence or using computing to try to claw our way away from the precipice, and the other one is, right, genetic engineering. And then even when you look at the name of the book, right, it was there used to be the statement that you could have everyone in the world on the Isle of Wight, I think it was, right, who could stand on the Isle of Wight with a certain amount of space between people. And at this point, we'd need a larger island, for instance, Zanzibar.
Yep.
I think that's, I mean, it's been a, The fear of overpopulation has been there pre-science fiction, even, where you go back and look at like works like A Modest Proposal. It was talking about, I don't know if you read that one in school.
I don't remember it.
Cannibalism, essentially. A Modest Proposal. We should start eating babies because there's too many of them. And yeah, I can't remember who wrote that, but it's like it's an example of Juvenalian satire, from what I recall.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think this is absolutely the kind of thing that science fiction should look at, right?
Yeah. I was kind of astonished that it had taken hold in 48 states. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, like from his point of view, 30 or 40 years in the future, you know, to 2010.
Right.
And then let alone around the world. So I did think it was one of those predictions, again, you know, that we have genetic testing now, 23andMe and, mm-hmm. and all the other sites where we can kind of pick these things out, or even before those, you know, pediatricians can do genetic tests mm-hmm. on your, you know, when you're pregnant to see if there might be any problems or what you might expect.
Right.
And then that would get used to determine if you could have kids or if the pregnancy would be aborted, you know, and it's not your choice. It's government, mm-hmm. government control.
Yeah. It's funny because even when you go to the origins of the eugenics stuff, right, it was all based on morphology rather than genetics, right? It's like, well, these traits, you know, are not part of the master race, right? Like the Dr. Mengele or whoever it was in Nazi Germany, right? Where it's we want to make sure that those people can't breed, right?
Yeah.
And taking it to genetics, I can sort of understand, like overpopulated Earth, you want to emphasize healthy births, and if you're doing it that way, I go, okay, I understand. You're not trying to ethnically cleanse by sterilizing people, but I don't see that that's going to ever become a widespread accepted thing.
Yeah, hopefully not.
Yeah. I mean, because there's been proposals for that, right? Where they're like, hey, in the inner cities, we should just offer sterilizations for, you know, welfare queens. And they're like, come on, that's just, don't try to pretend that's not racist.
Yatikang has I don't know if the U.S. does, it's not mentioned, but Yatikang, when Donald goes there, he can undergo voluntary temporary sterilization.
Right.
And he has to follow up however long he's there, he has mm-hmm. to follow up like every 2 weeks or every month to keep this going. And then it can be reversed when he leaves, right? He can mm-hmm. still have kids, but while he's there, he has to be sterilized.
They don't want him accidentally having kids while he's there. But yeah, the idea that there's a male fertility treatment is an interesting one.
It is. It is. I think it could be helpful in our society. Not necessarily sterilization, but male prevention, I guess.
Yeah. Male birth control.
Yeah.
There was a question that I had that I can't remember which part of the book it was from. One of the countries, and I can't remember if it was Beninia or Yatakang. I think it was Beninia. There was the wondering how it had stayed neutral and the idea that there was something in the genetics where when you interbred with these folks, it naturally kind of weeded out the aggressiveness.
Yeah, that was Beninia.
It was Beninia. Okay.
Yeah. Chad Mulligan goes there to try and figure out that. And then that's what he comes up with towards the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You try and conquer them and they end up conquering you by making you not want to go to war anymore.
Yep. And then that's one of the big philosophical issues right at the end was, do we take this and genetically engineer everybody on Earth with it? There was a little small debate. I think it was left up to the reader. It was like one of those things introduced right at the end to just make you think. Yeah.
Would that be a good thing?
Yeah. I don't know. I would say not genetically engineering everybody because that takes away their choice, mm-hmm. but like coming up with it and making it available or telling the world about it or something. Anything to make us more peaceful. So war is the, as I'm in the military, war is the stupidest thing there is. Yeah. I think.
I did think it was interesting that we have a character named President Obomi in this book. That's incredible.
Yep. President Obomi.
Yeah. This book also predicted kind of the downfall of the American auto industry down to like the underground music that cropped up when a lot of factories in Detroit folded, which actually happened.
Yep.
Crazy.
Yeah. There was a lot of tech in this. One of the things I always like to do at the end of our book club meetups is talk about some of the tech and like mm-hmm. accelerator tubes or like trains that can go from like Chicago to LA, in like 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Radio dresses or something like that. So like you're just wearing something that plays music.
Right.
I thought that was kind of fun.
Right.
There was something called polyforming kits, and they can make like modern art pieces that exist mm-hmm. in the real world, but you can do it yourself.
Right.
The museum of last week, I thought that could be, that's not tech, but that could have been something kind of fun, but that also leads into the news, we're flashed so much with news that we see so much of it that it's in one ear, out one ear. You might tell one person about it, but we'll actually forget what was in the article that we actually read. The museum of next week would kind of be like that, maybe a way to like remember, hey, this actually happened, before it is out of your brain and you're on to whatever the flavor of the day is.
Yeah. One of my favorite chapters in the book was the one where somebody dosed a preacher. with like a truth-telling drug, and he just went on this epic rant
giving
a sermon. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, that was really good. I think that was an attempted poisoning though, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
It didn't like fully take hold, and some of the side effects, if it doesn't kill you, are hallucinating, I guess. Mm-hmm. There are two churches. I wanted to ask you what you thought if one of the reasons for the split in the church in this story is because of eugenics. Like abortion is a big hot button item with the Catholic Church, of course.
Right.
So do you think?
I can't remember what the churches are named. There's like the true Catholics, no. And then there's the Sisters of something.
Or the Daughters. Divine Daughters.
Divine Daughters, yeah. And I can't remember which one was the more kind of conservative. There was one that was much more kind of going along with society, and the other one that was trying to be much more like have as many babies as you want kind of thing and defy all the eugenics laws.
Yeah, the Divine Daughters, I don't know which side they fell on, but I want to say they're more conservative because they were the like violent sect.
I was going to say it was one of them who was trying to sabotage Shalman Azar, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I always like when there's kind of projections about how would this impact spirituality, how would it impact the church? And definitely, there's things even now in our society that where you can see issues are going to have to come to a head at some point. And there's going to be one kind of last holdout about certain trends that we have. And certainly when you look at something like overpopulation and eugenics laws or forced abortion, that kind of stuff, you could see how the Catholic Church would be right there going, nope, we're going to stick to our guns here.
Yeah.
Perhaps literally.
Yeah. I didn't catch that the first time I read this. I just like, oh, there's two churches.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But then when I was sort of like thinking about it, I put the eugenics with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That the church was like, everyone, if you get pregnant, that child is to be born.
I should mention, so I was having a hard time making progress in this book, and I picked up the audiobook. And I will say that the tracking with close-ups, not tracking with close-ups, the Happening World, those chapters were really, really well executed by the narrator, because when he'd be reading headlines or advertisements, he really put on that kind of hammy, radio commercial kind of voice. And so, yeah, that was well executed, and it did help me get through the book quickly. I had a bunch of yard work to do because we were finally going to have people over to our house because we're all vaccinated.
Yeah.
And so one day I think I burned through half the book just in one day on audio, and then went back to print when I came back inside. But
I made the mistake of starting with the audiobook because I ordered it and it was going to take like a week or two. Uh-huh. And like we mentioned in the beginning, I had no idea of the format. So all this stuff was just going on in the audiobook and I could not track it.
Yeah.
And I just kind of stopped. I like froze and like had to wait for the book to show up and read what was just being talked about.
Yeah, that would be jarring, especially in the first Happening World chapters where sentences just cut off in the middle and you're like, is there something wrong with my audiobook?
Yeah, it's like you're listening to a commercial and you just change the channel in the middle of it.
Exactly. And that's print. I think that's what he's evoking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like you're
just flipping channels.
One of the things I thought funny with that was like we're at war. The U.S. is at war with some country in the Pacific. And at one point it talks about like one of the news flashes is like, U.S. won a major battle in whatever country, you know, casualties are listed as very low, but very high for the enemy. And then like two more bullets down, the Chinese won a major victory in whatever country, you know, casualty estimates are low, but major for the United States.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like controversial, conflicting news back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then whoever wins gets to write that history.
Pretty much. So I guess one of the last major points with this would be to talk about Chad Mulligan. So he's like we mentioned, like the philosophical narrator for this or what the author wanted to talk about. Turns out he's a really rich person who had spent the last 3 years pretending to be poor actually being poor and living in poverty on the streets of New York just because he was bored and whatever. Mm-hmm. Somehow he comes into contact with Norman and then subsequently meets Donald because they're roommates. And he gets very interested by the situation in Benigna. So he gets kind of hired by General Technics to do some sociology work there. And that's what leads to the discovery of the calming gene. I call it the calming gene.
Right.
But throughout he addresses like the board at General Technics and like just lays into them, right? With whatever, talking about how wrong the rich are for how they treat the poor and all these other things that we could do as a society and stuff like that. There's poetry throughout a couple poetry chapters throughout the book that are from his works, Chad Mulligan's works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was there anything you liked or really remembered?
Well, he also was kind of key in fixing Shalmaneser, right? Because he had gotten to, or the computer had gotten to where it's like, I can't accept the data as it's been inputted. It doesn't compute, essentially.
Right.
And I can't remember how he got around to it. He kind of got around it by saying, well, okay, can you just say, okay, assuming this is correct, then can you move to the conclusion? I can't remember how he untied it.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. And what Shalmaneser was having trouble accepting was the fact that the people of Benigna were peaceful. Like given a country that has, you know, a third, quote unquote, third world country, you know, poverty, not very good health care, you know, no money. They should be more violent or gang oriented or whatever than they are. And so the Shalmaneser couldn't accept the data that was being fed into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then so Chad was like, just assume it's correct. What would happen?
Right. Yeah. But he had to phrase his statements to Shalmaneser very carefully.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
And he wanted the challenge to see if he could still beat a computer. That computer hasn't, the AI hasn't taken over man's intellect.
Yeah, I thought that was funny too, because Norman is like, hey, I'm going to appoint you an advisor or something. And then he fixes Chalmanazar and he's like, well, I think I'm done. You know what? You don't need to hire me. I already did it.
Yeah. And everyone in the company is, all the IT professionals are looking at him like he's this godsend. Mm-hmm.
He just had an insight, right?
But pretty much.
Yeah. Did you say you read this for the first time, like in the spring or last spring, right?
Summer 2020. Yeah. That was the first time I read this.
Yeah.
For us. That's summer or fall.
That's the time scale we work on here at the Who Goes There podcast.
Well, I started reading through them probably early 2010s. Okay. And then when I started the book club, I kind of started back. I'm reading every now and again, I'll read one, you know, something that's interesting to me, like Hyperion that I'd heard a lot mm-hmm. about. But typically I've been going back and just kind of reading them in order. And this one I hadn't read yet. So we
nice.
Got to that year last summer. Now we're up to mid-70s. I think we're about to read the second Ursula K. Le Guin book for June.
Oh, nice. The Dispossessed?
Yep.
Yeah. Cool.
What do you think was the point of all the dozens of characters, most of which get killed?
I don't know.
I was like, some of them added very little to the world building.
Right.
And some of them were just pointless. The French couple, at one point, I think the main thing I took away from that was France isn't French anymore. There's a lot of interbreeding because at this point, the EU is sort of there, I guess, right. or their version of the EU, but is even more unlimited than the current one is. Like, people can go anywhere and just live. Yeah. Way more free than it is today. And some African nations have done that as well. There's something called RUNG, like Republic of United Nigeria and Ghana or something like that.
Right.
So this seems like it was his prediction was that this would happen in places all over the world.
Mm, the borders being, would kind of break down.
And being a huge Star Trek fan, like, I'm very excited. The EU makes me very excited. And then when Britain left, it was disappointing. And
right.
Like, if there were African countries that combined, you know, hopefully for good reasons and not just political or to take over other places.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you even look at like the Shadow series, Orson Scott Card, the ones that follow Bean. You know, you have the kind of rise of the hegemony and the, what do you call it, the free peoples of Earth. Where essentially like, hey, if you want to join us, if anybody picks on you, we'll take care of them. I mean, growing up in a conservative evangelical church, there is always a deep suspicion of anything that trended toward a one world government because of certain interpretations of prophecies in the Bible. And now I look at it and I'm like, well, why wouldn't we want to be united?
Yeah.
I don't see the downside.
Nope.
Yeah. But, you know, some folks are like, well, but if everybody interbreeds, then we'll lose our distinctives. I'm like, our distinctives are usually what causes problems.
Yeah. That was one of our topics in Ringworld, I believe. The main character, like in the first chapter, is described as being all these different things and that humanity is just kind of homogenized because of the,
yeah.
like the gates where you just walk in and teleport across the planet.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I don't think that's necessarily that bad of a thing. And mm-hmm. I don't see our cultures, you know, our native musics, our native foods and stuff like that. I don't see that going away just because we intermarry or interbreed, you know?
Yeah.
Languages do, so maybe I'm wrong. You know, you get a group together and the languages will just start intermingling until it's a new language 20 or 30 years later.
Right.
But.
Yep. But no, you know, we can't let these other people erase us, you know.
Yeah.
That was, have you seen Borat 2?
Not yet. I don't know if I'm going to.
At some point, he goes into a bakery and asks for a cake. And on the cake, and I can't remember where he is. He's in the South somewhere, I think. And he asks the lady to write, Jews will not replace us, you know, which was one of the things, shouted by the tiki torch carrying morons. And, you know, she just goes ahead and writes it on the cake. And I'm like, get the hell out of my shop. I don't get it.
Yeah. One of the last things to talk about is in the world building with the overpopulation in New York, there's a dome over New York City. Mm-hmm. And they've built buildings over the streets. So like the high rises and the skyscrapers have buildings over the street to sit for extra space. Trash is picked up like once a month or more. It just seems like it's just not a good place to be. There was another thing I was going to say on that.
Yeah, it's interesting in the book that if you only followed those main characters, you wouldn't really get that view down into the street level stuff. And that's where you get the tracking with close-ups and the happening world where you actually have that. I guess more the tracking with close-ups, right?
Yeah. One of the tracking with close-ups chapters is a kid who gets drafted, and he has an old man friend, and he gives him like some kind of like prohibited by the government book, and like he somehow gets caught with this book, so he gets discharged from the service, like saving his life or whatever. But there was a lot of anti-war sentiment in that chapter, like heavy. And this being kind of right around Vietnam, of course, that made sense to be in the book. Mm-hmm. Muckers, people who just run amok and start mass shootings. That unfortunately is kind of prophetic for the last decade.
Yeah, even all the way back to, you know, the 80s and the term going postal, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the other things is like not a lot of people smoke, but a lot of people use marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess they do smoke marijuana, but not tobacco.
Yeah.
And that's completely okay. Even for a character like Norman, who's Muslim, right? Where he won't drink alcohol, but he'll smoke some of the hippie lettuce.
Yeah. This was one of the first Hugos that I felt like referenced previous Hugos a lot. Mm. Chad, when he talks to the Shomanizer, talks into the mic, M-I-K-E. MIC, and that Mike is the computer from Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah, I saw that too and thought, I wonder if that's a reference.
There were several other books that this was like connected to. Lunatics, for people who work on the moon. I thought that was a great term. Right. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of world building in this one. It was, you definitely got a really good complete picture of what's going on.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, we can kind of start moving towards final thoughts. And this, I wouldn't say is one of my favorites. And I think it's definitely high on my list of ones that I'd like to reread. There's some of them where like, I want to reread them because they're so well regarded and I didn't totally get them. You know, they didn't connect with me the same way. This one, you know, by the end of it, when I kind of got immersed in it, in that long session of pulling weeds, and listening to the audiobook, you know, I really did enjoy it. But I feel like I would enjoy it more on a reread.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to rereading it, hopefully later this year.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to hear another podcast on this, you can go check out David Agronoff did an episode of Dickheads with a guest talking about this book, and they both rave about it. And so if you want to hear them talk about it, go for it. I'll put a link in the show notes.
My final thoughts, kind of like you, this isn't one of my favorite Hugos. I think there's just too much racism, and I can't believe that they believe that it would still be that prevalent in 2010. And there's a case to be made that there's still a lot of racism and stuff like that, especially with what's going on last year. A lot of the characters seem like they relish when bad things happen to other people in this book, and I wasn't on board with that, but. The Chad Mulligan stuff, there's a lot of philosophical stuff to think about, you know, the benefits or bad stuff to go with genetic engineering, you know, taking how much, you know, government should be involved or corporations should be involved in helping everyday people, you know, with education and salary and training and living. There's a lot to kind of sink your teeth into, and maybe a reread will bring out some other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if I reread it, I'd want to try and push in and figure out General Technics is not just being altruistic in wanting to take over the economy of Benicia, right? They're out for profit.
They are. They're building some kind of giant port to do a underwater mining operation.
Yeah, yeah. So they're going to exploit it. Now there could be good effects to go along with it to offset some of the negative stuff, but yeah, I wasn't totally sure what to think of their motives.
And President Obama was just worried about his people when he turns out he shouldn't have been.
Right. Yeah. They're going to probably be fine. Yeah. It's an interesting book. Yep. All right. I think that'll suffice for final thoughts. So is there any place people can find you?
No, not really. I'm on Facebook, but I've had ideas for a podcast. It hasn't kind of got off the ground yet. If you live in Northern Virginia and want to be in a Hugo podcast or a Hugo book club, look me up. It's called Nova Hugo Readers on Facebook.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, maybe I'll throw a link in the show notes to that. And if you ever get your podcast off the ground, let me know if you need a guest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It'd be great. You were one of my first ones, but you keep talking about how much you already have to read. And
yes, that definitely is a factor. But, you know, I'm coming around more to just like, you know what, there's stuff I'm not going to get to unless I take it in on audio. And so I'm just going to do it that way.
Yeah. I do a mix now. Like I'll get the book so I have a reference, especially for how to spell things or get a visual. Yeah. And then I'll listen to the audiobook in my car or if I'm working out or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Because I am a slow reader. So audiobooks kind of, they move at their own speed, or you can actually speed them up.
Oh yeah. I always speed them up.
Well, thanks, Seth. This was great. And this is, like we mentioned, definitely a novel to think about or sink your teeth into.
Yeah. I think that's the right way to put it, right? This is one to think about, to mull around a little bit. And it definitely is something that it's good to have a discussion about. So I really want to thank you for picking it and for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Okay. Cool. Well, it was great talking to you. Nice to meet you. Thank you for your service.
Absolutely. I appreciate being here. Thanks.
Yep. All right. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Chip. And I definitely recommend you check out Stand on Zanzibar. I will put at least one link in the show notes to other discussions. And I want you to keep in mind, right, I don't present this podcast as the definitive discussion of any of these books. It's just a discussion between me and a guest. We go the direction that the guest wants to take it, and I put it out there, and you know, people can check it out. But there's a whole family of podcasts and other content around the Hugos, and I encourage you to, of course, check all of those out as well. Apologies for this one being a little bit late. It was a combination of factors, me not getting through the book, and then Chip getting very ill. And so we had to kind of wait that out until his voice had recovered. So I will try and get the next episode out on the correct schedule. Of course, I want to invite you, if you want to support the podcasting that I do here and on Take Me to Your Reader, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support for as little as $1 a month. I've not been doing a ton of exclusive content over there, but I am going to get some of that in the near future. But if you'd like to support in a non-monetary fashion, retweet, share with your friends, leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast, I'd really appreciate that. And just a final little plug here for Zencastr, which is the platform that I use to host the podcast discussions and do the recordings. Very, very handy tool. It's been, I know, hugely important for people during the pandemic year, but I was using it before it was cool. So if you want to check it out, if you're an aspiring podcaster, go to zencastr.com and check them out. Okay, I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.